kautta me haleja, ui kui hule kaleja, ui kui hule.
Welcome to the California Indian Radio Project.
Ui kui hule kaleja, ui kui hule kaleja, kautta me haleja.
This program is honoring our grief, healing the wounds.
It's just been three generations ago that people were actually slaughtered here by the thousands, butchered. In our language, we call the Euro-American nakniti, the one who brandishes the knife, because they just hack people to death with it, these big old heavy knives.
We're talking about our grandparents. We're talking about aunties. We're talking about real people, not someone out of a history book.
That's why we really have to look at the trauma, is because whether it happened three generations ago, it influences our actions, our thoughts, the way we see ourselves as Indian people.
In 1998, California began the celebration of 150 years of statehood. However, for California Indians, it was no celebration. The gold rush and subsequent 20 years were some of the most devastating times for Indians in the Sierras and Northern California, who had been relatively unaffected by the missions. Between 1769 and 1850, at least 150,000 California Indians had died of disease and mistreatment. Over the next 20 years, another 120,000 were killed. Less than 30,000 Indians remained in 1870. Although they were expected to totally vanish, they have survived. Because of the extent of the loss, those who survived carried the trauma and grief with them. This is known as multigenerational or historical grief and trauma. But much is being done to heal these wounds. I'm Susan Newstead.
Chimu chumu pa nikwa wara niku pesh karuma pantipu aniku peshara.
Gail Zepeda is Pomo. She works as manager of community resources for Northern Circle Indian Housing and also works as a facilitator for the Gathering of Native Americans, 4 days of workshop and ceremony available to individual tribes as one way to begin the healing process.
One of the things that I think is real critical in addressing multigenerational trauma for Indian people on a very personal level is the fact that you've named it, that you've validated all those feelings that people have had for so long but have not put a label to it. People have felt all the symptoms of multigenerational trauma but have never had that validated. So many Indian people who have experienced some trauma have tried to stuff it or stifle it or ignore their feelings or wonder, why am I feeling like this? What's wrong with me? One of the things that we've come to realize is that that is the root of substance abuse and dysfunction in community, is this unresolved trauma, and that the alcohol issues that are real serious in our communities is about people trying not to feel those things that are just so painful to them. And it's very difficult for non-Native communities to want to hear those stories and those community dialogues because I think it's so close, you know, because the initial reaction is one of being defensive of, you know, I didn't do that to Indian people. You know, I didn't think it was right. I didn't support it. You know, so why are you attacking me about it? Because I didn't do it. And it's a very human response on some level. But one of the things that we try to ask non-Indian people is to kind of go with that initial reaction that you're having, but at the same time kind of work through it and listen. Listen. All we're asking is for people to listen. And if you can listen to that pain that we've experienced, we will move beyond that point of having to vent and have the anger and come to a place of where we can come together and move forward. But what I see happening in communities so many times is when Native people begin to talk about those things, non-Indians get very uncomfortable and don't want to hear it. And so it's either stifled or cut off, or they never come back to complete that dialogue. And so again, Indian people feel like their voice has not been heard, and it's further traumatizing on some level that they close up. And so you see that happening on both sides. And so that's one of the things I think is real important, is for people to tell their stories, that there's a lot of power in people telling their stories.
He was living in the Hat Creek Valley in a village with his people.
Darrell Babe Wilson is Pitt River and is the father of seven sons. He completed his PhD at the University of Arizona. Writing his dissertation on the history of his people between 1830 and 1875. One of the sources he used for that dissertation was an autobiography of Nidhi Nicey, Darrell's foster mother's grandfather. The events in this story happened when Nidhi Nicey was around 9 years old.
The vigilantes and the army came into the Hat Creek Valley on several occasions, but on this particular one, they took him, burnt down the village and killed the people and rounded up those that they wanted to survive. And they took them to Fort Crook in the Fall River Valley, rounded up many people in my homeland. And when they got enough for a drive, what they called a drive, just like a cattle drive, enough for a drive, they would march them over the mountains into the Sacramento Valley, just south of Redding, California. In the process, at that time, the military attitude was that the last person, the straggling person, would automatically be shot, which would cause the rest of the tribal people to not straggle and to keep up with everybody that was marching through the snow. Nidhi Nicey's father was carrying him because he didn't have any shoes, I understand. Very cold in the wintertime in my homeland. His mother was carrying his brother, and she was lagging behind. The army shot the mother and the baby, and then prepared to shoot the father and Nidhi Nicey. They were forced at gunpoint to turn and march with the rest of the people. He survived to tell us this story.
It was not unusual for the vigilantes to simply massacre whole villages. Widespread public opinion in Northern California at that time was that the Indians should be exterminated. James Rawls is an instructor of history at Diablo Valley College and author of several books, including Indians of California, The Changing Image.
You can read in the newspapers, in the editorials, in the news stories, countless positions of advocacy that we must exterminate these people. We must kill every single one of them. Nits will be lice. We must kill the children. We must kill the breeders, the women. We must kill the bucks, the men. Those are the words that were used. You can dip into any of the Northern California newspapers in the 1850s, 60s, into the early 70s, and you will find those kinds of articles and statements. These extermination campaigns were supported by public policy, not just public opinion. In many communities in Northern California, there were subscriptions or bounties that were available to the Indian hunters or the Indian killers. All you needed to do was to bring in evidence of your kill, and that could be heads, scalps, or ears. And we have descriptions of men bringing in burlap sacks of scalps dripping with blood, or ears in some cases that had been removed from their victims, or most commonly the heads that were brought in. I remember reading one description outside of Marysville where there was a subscription for the Indian hunters, and a man brought in a mule with a dozen or more Indian heads lashed to the flanks of the mule, just bobbing along as he came to the city location where these bounties were available. Not only was there bounties from the local government for the evidence of your kill, But then the legislature of the state of California provided compensation for the expenses that a person might incur in doing this public work. So if you expended so much ammo or so much food for your horse or food for yourself or whatever it was, maybe lost wages while you were out doing this public good, you could submit your expense accounts to the state legislature. The legislature, time and again, authorized those payments, and this amounted to more than $1 million of public fund. Then the state submitted those claims on to the federal authority. And so the National Congress of the United States, on two occasions, compensated or reimbursed the state of California, again, in excess of $1 million. So this leads us to the conclusion that the extermination of the Indians of California, while it was often carried out by ad hoc bands of volunteers, was really a matter of public policy that was subsidized on the local, state, and federal level. It was mass murder, publicly subsidized, carried out under the color of law. And if that is not genocide, I don't know what is.
Some people preferred to use Indians as cheap labor. This had begun with the missions, who captured or coerced Indians into the mission and then kept them there by force. Mexican and Anglo ranchers who followed the mission era continued the practice of using Indian labor, often without compensation. A law passed by the state legislature in 1850 made it legal to declare any Indian a vagrant and have them sold at public auction. The Indian then had to work for the buyer without compensation for 4 months. Another part of this law provided for the apprenticeship of Indian children, whereby any white person could obtain the labor of any number of Indian children for an indefinite amount of time. At first, girls were held until they were 15 and boys 18, but this was later changed to 25 and 30. Men who saw this as an opportunity to make money would travel into native areas and kidnap children. James Rawls.
Under the guise of apprentices, they would be sold to whites seeking young labor in their homes as domestic servants in the rural areas, as agricultural workers. And as you might suspect, there was a great deal of sexual exploitation here of the young Indian girls and the young women as well. About 5 years ago, I was giving a public talk on the process of kidnapping Indian children and selling them into slavery and so on. This was up in Ukiah in Mendocino County. And after the talk, an elderly white man, a rancher, came forward, and he was very agitated and very upset. And he said he had never heard this sort of thing talked about before publicly. And it was obviously very disturbing to him that it had just been talked about. He said that he had known about this all his life, however, but he thought it was a family secret. He said his great-grandfather had been involved in this and that he had made more money selling the surplus Indians off his land, as he put it, than running cattle. And he invited me to come up to the ranch. He said, I can show you where the bones are, where the parents had been killed, so that the children could be sold. I said, no, thank you. While he was telling this to me, a couple of elderly Pomo women came forward, Pomo Indian women, listening to what he was saying. And they were also upset. They were nearly in tears. And so when this rancher completed his story, they said, well, we've never heard this talked about before either, this business of kidnapping children and killing their parents. But we've known this all our lives. Our great-grandmother told us about this, and we thought it was a kind of family secret that we could not and should not share. Our great-grandmother told us one day a group of whites were chasing her, trying to get her children. She got them across the Navarro River, with one exception, a small child, her youngest, who was left behind in a cradle board by a large rock under some brush. The white men were firing at them as they got across the river. It was then later in the day. Evening fell. The mother came back around to find the one child that she had left. And she saw the child was still there. She breathed a sigh of relief. She lifted up the brush and she found the child there, pinned to the earth with a knife through its chest into the earth. At that point, these two ladies started crying as if it had just happened. And there was a moment of silence. And then the rancher turned to me. He had been listening to this also. And he said to me, "You better believe them. They're telling you the truth." And I had this feeling that both of these families knew that story. They'd never shared it before. It had been an unspoken, unacknowledged story in their family histories. And now by sharing that story in the presence of one another and having this sense of recognition, of owning up to this story, that maybe this wound that was very deep in both of those families, a wound that had been left unattended for so long, now might have the possibility of beginning to heal.
Because the changes were so total, traditional systems of community support for the grieving process were devastated, so these deep wounds were passed on through the generations. Barbara Aragon is Laguna Pueblo and Crow. She is director of training with the American Indian Training Institute in Sacramento, and she is also a trainer with the Gathering of Native Americans, helping communities deal with these issues.
I don't want to even pretend that I can tell California's story, you know. It's all so personal. But the commonalities are, if I experience a loss of a loved one, the loss is just so huge. And it's going to take a long time for me to get through it. And I'll need a lot of support. Okay. And so many times, if I experienced that loss, my siblings would come, the community would come. There would be ways that the community would acknowledge that loss and support me through that loss and help me through that process. If you look at any intact culture throughout the world, all of them have ritual, ceremony, different ways that they acknowledge and help one another through a grief process.
If the loss affects most or all of the people in a community, such as being removed from their land, or many families dying from disease or massacres, there may be no one unaffected enough to provide the support needed to complete that grieving process.
So some of that ability to deal with grief, or that support, or those resources are gone, the larger the loss is with the community. I think many communities did get to the point where you became so disempowered, you become hopeless, helpless, you know, depressed, the anger, and beyond anger, the rage that occurs from this, that people will take that rage and that pain and they either turn it towards themselves, and where you see substance abuse, do you see depression, you see suicide, you see mental illness, or many times they turn it outside themselves, and sometimes it'll go towards their family and their community and domestic violence. And so you see all of these symptoms of unresolved grief in our communities.
Mental health professionals have begun to develop ways to recognize and complete this grieving cycle and bring healing. Jim McQuillan is Yurok and Talawa. He is a licensed marriage family child therapist and is director of the Child and Family Services Department at United Indian Health Services for 9 tribes in Northwest California.
So information, really very clear information on what happened in our own history, is a healing technique that we use. Have people understand why the culture was interrupted and what happened in their own history, maybe what displaced them from their own land, what displaced them from their own language and traditions and family values, and begin to understand that history, you know, over the last 200 years, what happened here on the North Coast. That's one very important, vital technique that we use, helping to develop the atmosphere or arenas where people can begin to talk about this stuff in a safe place. And then other techniques are, again, going back to ceremony, relinking families and individuals to their customs and traditions, getting back to basics, you know, if it's singing or just simply attending ceremony, helping people reconnect that way. And then, of course, we use some of the modern techniques also of just basic family counseling, of helping people work on communication and identifying their feelings, if it's massive grief and depression or the anger that later comes up in that process, of being able to express that anger in a healthy way.
And it isn't just the old grief that needs to be healed. Gail Zepeda.
In Mendocino County, we can talk about things that have happened within my generation. I'm 46 years old, and I still remember my grandmother chastising us and saying, you know, when we go to town, you can't be running around, don't be talking, you know, don't do this, you know, because they're going to take you away from me if you do. And I used to wonder why, as I went to school and learned about child development, and I was feeling rather smug and thinking, you know, gosh, why'd she say that to us as little kids? You know, that's making us fearful and wasn't really good for our self-esteem. But then I realized during that same era was the time when social services, church groups, at their will, were taking Indian children, were making judgment about Indian parents, and were able to take Indian children. So in 1972, that's when the Indian Child Welfare Act was created, to protect Indian children, to keep them from non-Indians taking them and removing them from their homes. And that happened in my lifetime.
From the 1880s to the 1930s, generations of Indian children were taken away from their parents and sent to boarding school, where they had to stay year-round. Kathy Morse is Navajo. She's a physician practicing family medicine in the Sacramento Valley and is medical services director for the California Rural Indian Health Board.
I would do a fair amount of work with traditional healers. One that I know that does a lot of work down towards the central part of California, on way up to the northern part, he does a lot of traveling. He has said that the worst problems that he has seen in terms of alcoholism and family violence have been in those families in which the parents have gone to boarding school. You think about it. Some child is taken at an extremely young age away from their home, away from everybody that they loved. In my mother's case, she was taken away from her grandmother, who was raising her in a traditional manner. And think about it, being put in just a totally foreign culture and no parents there, just other kids, a lot of punishment, a lot of despair, and homesickness. How does one learn to be a parent in that type of environment? You learn the punishment. And in the case of many young Indian children, learn about child sexual abuse in that manner. And then how does one expect them to be good parents and become well-adjusted? And so these problems end up going on to the next generations unless they're stopped and healed.
Although most Indian children now attend public schools, their true history is usually not part of the curriculum. Lauren Bommelin is Talua and teaches art and the Talua language in Del Norte County High School.
When I grew up, it was horrible to live in a vacuum. To go into school and to be invisible, to go into school and not have a history, to be chapter 6 in your sociology book in fifth grade called The Vanishing American, you know, that by 1960 we'd be extinct, and how wonderful that was because we finally made it. You know, we're now American. And I grew up with that horror feeling of genocide, this feeling of extinction, of transparency. And it just took my self-esteem and just shoved it in a hole in the ground, you know. And I fought that my whole life. I have fought that my whole life, and I've learned to come to terms to degrees with that. So there are people like me out there, you know, that are still in that place. Their head is still being stepped on today. Their hearts are being trampled in the dirt.
Thank you.
Traditional ceremonies and ritual are an important part of the healing. Jim McQuillan.
The mental health staff here are very much involved here. Most of us in the department are very, very attached to the ceremonies and encourage community members as a part of their healing to get back involved. And even if they carry one feather or they bring acorns to that ceremony, becoming a part of that again and reviving their family tradition, whether they were a singing family and they carried beautiful songs, encouraging that to revive and restore that spirituality and that identity that they carry with them. Very important for the mental health and recovery of the people here. And I'm very proud to say that our dances are making a comeback in this area.
Cultural revival, being able to dialogue about it, bringing people together and allowing them to tell their stories are all parts and pieces of that healing and recovery that has to happen, and it's very powerful for people.
It's really a process, and one thing that I think I had realized is that if I didn't get a hold of it, it would have destroyed me. You just can't live in that dichotomy and not give it a name, not label it, not give it a face, and be able to deal with it, because it's just knocking you out subconsciously. I mean, it's just coming around from the backside and hitting you alongside the head, and you don't know why. So it's been a journey in my lifetime to try to come to terms with that, to understand that, and then what to do with that, and then move through that. And it's never gone, but at least it doesn't control you.
Healing cannot take place physically, emotionally, spiritually, unless this pain or damage is brought right out in the open and addressed. But to keep it inside, that's one of our big problems with Native people all across this continent, to keep grief, to keep pain inside, is to allow yourself to die moment by moment.
What is exciting to me is to really begin to see people move from being stuck in looking at the losses of their land, looking at the losses of their culture, going beyond the anger, and to me it's very righteous anger, and to begin to say, okay, but if I stay here, then nothing's going to change. And change is not going to come from outside. It's going to come from within the community. And that whole empowerment within the Indian community, to me, is very exciting.
Honoring Our Grief, Healing the Wounds. This program was written and produced by Susan Newstead. Executive producer, Peggy Berryhill. Project director, Roby Cook. Digital editing and mixing, Neil Harvey. Thanks to Kit High for production assistance. We would like to thank the following musicians: Nancy Richardson Steele, Ernest Siva, Peter Cater, and Arl Carlos Nakai. Thanks also to the singers whose music came from the California Indian Library Collection. The music of Koljidimo appears in our opening theme. This program is a project of Northern California Cultural Communications, with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For the California Indian Radio Project, I'm Neil Harvey.
To order a cassette tape of this program or a resource guide with more information about the people and topics we've covered, call 1-800-461-3991. That's 1-800-461-3991. Or visit our website at flickerfeather.org.
This program is distributed by the American Indian Radio on satellite, a service of Native American Public Telecommunications.